And that's what I think all artists do with, you know, whether they paint or sculpt. It's all just, you get into this thing of millimeters, that where it's like, no, let me say, I don't need that word, cut that word. You know, you're just trying to get it precise, you know?
From Louisville Public Media, this is Five Things, the show that tells a life story through the objects we treasure. I'm Tara Anderson. Louisville is very fortunate to have several legacy arts organizations, more than some other cities the same size. We have a longtime orchestra, a ballet, opera company, art museum, and a theater for young audiences. All of those organizations have experienced new leadership in the last few years, which is super exciting. And the newest of those leaders is my guest on Five Things today.
My name is Idris Goodwin. I am the producing artistic director of Stage One Family Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. I am a playwright, a director, orator, and dad.
And you're new to this job here at Stage One.
I am new to this job here at Stage One, yes.
When did you take over?
July. Start of July.
Take over. I made it sound like it was a coup or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Here he comes.
Yeah. The chaos began in July when I started. I began in July.
And what interested you about being at this theater for young audiences?
So I've actually written two plays for Stage One in the past. So the first play that I wrote from them was And In This Corner, Cassius Clay. Which is actually one of my things,
awesome.
Is the script for that. But And In This Corner, Cassius Clay, which is about the young life of Muhammad Ali growing up here in Louisville. And it's about how he got into boxing and that whole story, the story of the red bicycle, et cetera. And then I wrote another play for them a couple years later called American Tales, which is sort of my take on three American folk tales. And that went up last March. So that's fairly recent. So I've known them for a while, and we've kept in touch. And Peter, my predecessor, and I had a good relationship and would talk shop all the time. And we have been talking about trying to do, you know, create a more permanent situation, more so as me as a playwright in residence. And that just wasn't really panning out. And so He was ready to move on and do something else. I was coming up on about 6 years of teaching at a liberal arts college in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I was kind of interested in doing something else, And so the timing just sort of worked out. So I stepped into this role. But one of the things I've always been committed to is education and theater and the arts, just as a tool for helping young people on their journey. It's something that I wish that I had more of when I was growing up, And so I've committed myself to trying to become the person or be a part of things that I wish were in my life when I was a kid.
That's a great goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about too. I've seen this thing going around on the internet, like be the person you needed when you were an adolescent. Maybe.
Yeah, because that's attainable. That's attainable because you know what you needed. Mm-hmm. And so you can try to really, it's very attainable. You're like, okay, who would I have wanted to be, you know, have met, you know, and what would I have wanted this person to say to me, and how would I have wanted this person to challenge me, and what would I have wanted this person to expose me to, you know, all of those kinds of things. And so I feel like that's something that I can deal with. I can attain that, you know what I mean? Versus like, I'm going to be the richest man in the world and like whatever, like that's, you know, too overwhelming to think about.
Well, you picked theater, so we know that wasn't really your goal.
No, but I'm still holding out. It's still possible.
It could happen.
Listen, Lin-Manuel Miranda's doing okay.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
He's just a theater nerd who loved plays and you know, wrote something that now can basically print its own money, essentially, ironically.
$10 bills?
Yeah, ironically, can print its own $10 bills, you know what I mean? So
we're sitting here talking in the rehearsal hall at Stage One, and there are people milling about outside doing busy work of getting ready for the next season. I asked you to pick out five things that have been significant or resonant in some way, and we're going to learn more about you. Where would you like to start?
I actually want to start with, it was really hard to find five things specifically. I don't have a lot of keepsakes per se. I don't have like talisman and things like that. I tend to lose a lot of stuff. But I was thinking the thing that I really retain most are like art objects. So books, albums, movies, posters, things like that. And finally I just decided I'm gonna go all books. So these are five books. Great. I had to narrow it a little bit.
Yeah.
And I tried to be as personal as possible. So the first book I have here is a copy of Can't Stop, Won't Stop by Jeff Chang. It won the American Book Award in 2005, I want to say. And basically, you know, it's like a cultural studies book. It's a nonfiction book, but it's basically about hip-hop, and it's the sort of history of the hip-hop, what he calls the hip-hop generation. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily just about the music, right? So we think of hip-hop, we think of songs, right? But the songs are just the artifact of this culture,
right?
This whole, you know, rich and multicultural and complicated culture that came out of, like, young people in the South Bronx that has ties to Jamaica and has ties to South America and, you know, and just has this rich history. And so Jeff, who's a music writer, started digging into it, you know, and getting people's stories and, like, why were you dancing like you dance, and why did you guys touch the records like that, and what happened when the big corporations started giving you record deals, and when breakdancers and rappers and DJs started making money, what happened with the graffiti artists who were riding on trains and anonymous, you know,
yeah,
who got left out of the big cash cow, you know? So he's really telling that story in the book. And when I read this book, this was at a time where a lot of us who grew up with hip hop, but we're in the nonprofit world, we're working at theaters, we're trying to publish books, we're trying to find a way, you know, how can we as people who are influenced by this culture break into other worlds that have been off to us? Because up to that point, it was like rap music. And like, maybe if you become successful as a rapper, you can maybe get a sitcom, or
mm-hmm.
you can get, you know, a movie deal or something like that. But mm-hmm. that was kind of about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying to figure that out. Like, wow, I'm interested in poetry, but I also love all this rap music, and my poetry sounds like rap, but people think I'm a rapper, but I'm not a rapper, you know?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of stuff going on. So for this book to come out, which is a nonfiction book, a cultural studies book, but it's about hip hop, like from someone who's a part of that culture, reading it just really blew my mind. And it mm-hmm. also taught me all these things that I didn't know about this culture that I thought I was pretty familiar with. It just deepened the conversation. It was innovative, but there was a beautiful simplicity to it. It's really just well written. And Jeff was one of ours. Jeff was someone we kind of knew in our sort of extended community.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look inside the book, you'll see on, you know, on the first pages here, he signed it for me.
Oh, nice.
And all the things that I've lost over the years, I've hung on to this, and I've loaned this book out, and I've managed mm-hmm. to get it back. I've decided I'm actually going to stop loaning it out. And funny, it says, Idris, here's your book, right? And the reason he says that first is because I was really bugging him, because I had just met him in Chicago pretty much right around when the book came out, and I would send him these nagging emails like, yo, man, I want a book, man. I need a signed copy of your book. You know what I mean? And so the first thing he says is, Idris, here's your book. And then it says, thanks for the love, support, and inspiration. I love that he says inspiration, because it made me feel a little bit like a peer. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And he says, enjoy, much respect, you know, Jeff Chang. So this is something that's meant a lot to me, just in terms of going into these new spaces, theater companies, other nonprofits, you know, getting to kind of play in bigger arenas, but also at my core, I'm still just a hip hop kid. I'm still just a kid who, you know, who's writing like bad rap songs in his room, and I still have that spirit. And I just think there's something that we have to share that all the other fields, the arts, education, you know, can benefit from. And in turn, they'll enrich us and teach us mm-hmm. things as well. So that's one.
So part of the significance of this book for you was having hip-hop taken seriously as an art form, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, and it won the American Book Award that year. And that was, you know, and so that's the thing, too. It's like when anybody from hip-hop does well, it's like kind of a win for the whole culture, right? So, you know, a lot of my friends, some of them are skeptical of Hamilton. Some of them like it. Some of them don't. But I think the one thing we can all agree on is that it's important for hip hop. You know what I'm saying? That the creator of this thing loves the culture, can quote raps, you know, seminal raps. And ultimately, I think his motives were to get the world of Broadway, which is a lot more closed off than people would think, a lot more conservative than people would think, and really be like, no, listen, this is not just some song and dance thing we're doing. Like, we're serious artists. And in the same way that DJs took any kind of records, you know, when people say hip hop music, I kind of chuckle, because it's DJ music. It started with DJs,
yeah,
which means it's all music. It's just broken down. It's taken apart. It's flipped. It's like, we like the rhythm section more than we like the big solo, you know, whatever. And so similarly with something like Hamilton, it's like, you know, he's working within an established format, but he's just sort of hotting it up. Like, you know what I mean? He's just sort of like bringing it into the 21st century and reviving it.
What was the first hip-hop song that really like grabbed you by the throat?
I mean, of course, Rapper's Delight, right? I mean, 1979, I was like 2 years old. You know, my parents threw these great parties when I was a kid, and that record was always playing.
And where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and in and around. We lived in the city for a long time, then we lived in the suburbs when I was in middle school and high school. Yeah, just those early days of, you know, late 70s, early 80s, all that funk and disco, post-disco, and all that early hip-hop that was bubbling up then. So, yeah, Rapper's Delight, of course. You know, I loved, I mean, you know, in 1988 was a big year for rap music. It was like sort of this new generation of artists that came out. So, like, Big Daddy Kane and Public Enemy. Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet is one of my favorite albums. It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back is an important Public Enemy record that came out in 88, and that one was a pretty big one for me. So yeah, that whole era, that 1988 era, and I wrote a play about it called How We Got On, actually, which was the first play that actually brought me to Louisville that they did at Actors Theater in Humana in 2012. And so that play is really kind of my love letter to 1988 hip-hop. Mm-hmm.
So in addition to that play, to directly addressing hip-hop, have the methods or the processes of hip-hop influenced your work in other ways?
That's a great question. That kind of actually leads me to my...
To the second thing?
Yeah, that kind of leads me to the second thing.
I love it when that happens.
Yeah. So the second book, and this is very sort of directly tied into the Jeff Chang book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And so this book is called The Breakbeat Poets Anthology. And it's a relatively new anthology, came out on Haymarket Books. And it's really just a collection of, you know, multi-generational poets who were influenced by hip-hop culture. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's some people that were kids when DJ Kool Herc in 1973 began to actually blend records. And then it ends with a couple of teenagers, you know, who have grown up on multiple generations of rap music. But the reason why I brought it is for two reasons. One is the name The Breakbeat Poets. That's a term that I actually coined. And I was on the phone with one of the editors, Kevin Koval. It had to be like, you know, almost 10 years. No, I think literally, 10, maybe 11 years ago. We were on the phone just shooting a GIF as we do. And I just said, you know, it's like we're breakbeat poets, you know. And what I meant by that is, you know, so like the foundation of rock and roll, of blues, is the pentatonic scale with an additional what they call a blue note or a worried note, right? But that pentatonic scale or the blues scale is pretty much the foundation. So in hip hop, the breakbeat is the foundation. The breakbeat is just basically the breakdown section of like a funk record or a rock record. So part of how Aerosmith, Run DMC, Walk This Way came to be is that one of the popular breakbeats that they use is that opening from the Aerosmith song Walk This Way. Right. So that, they would just loop that over and over and over again.
It's like the fingerprint of the, of the song.
Yeah, so it's just that hard, it's the breakbeat part of the record. So I was saying that, you know, for a lot of us, one of the ways that we first show creativity was writing our own raps over instrumentals, over breakbeats. And that's where we learned about poetry. That's how we learned about meter and we learned about word choice and all of that. And so that was kind of the point I was making. And Kevin, just for whatever reason, hung on to that. He just loved that. And flash forward, you know, this anthology appears. And so the reason that I brought this, or what it was important for me, it was a reminder that the crazy ideas you have, the things that you say randomly, A, that people are actually listening, and B, they can materialize. you know, you never know how they're going to materialize. So hang on to those ideas. So I keep, you know, folders with my ideas, and I've gotten really good at pitching my ideas, and I've gotten a lot more confident in being like, no, that's actually not a stupid idea or a bad idea or whatever, yeah. You know. So, and then the second piece of this is just recently I was at the South Central Library here in Louisville. To me, a measure of a library is their poetry and their drama section. Mm. I always look for that because we typically don't have our own section. It's always just kind of woven into other stuff, right. To larger sections. I saw this anthology at the South Central Public Library here in Louisville, which was just a great surprise. So again, it's like kind of full circle, right? Like, you know, my first play and my first foray into like hip hop on the theatrical stage is here in Louisville. I'm now running this children's theater now. And then the book, the anthology that has a title of a word that I coined is also in this library in this new city I live in. So it's just like all of those kind of connections are significant to me. I keep my antenna peaked for those kind of moments and pieces the universe gives us that reminds us of, like, you know, these things are connected, you're here for a reason, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So you think you're in Louisville for a reason?
Yes, of course.
Do you know what it is yet?
No. Talking to you about my five things.
That's right. Do you consider yourself a poet?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, poetry to me is the root of all creative writing. Mm. Because what is poetry? Well, it's poetry is crafting words together to evoke feelings that are complex. So the key to like blues poetry, for example, or like the lyrics of blues are like, you know, using very simple words to convey very complex realities and emotions.
And it seems to me also one of the important things about poetry is condensed language, right?
Yeah.
Which I think also happens in hip hop. I am not an authority on hip hop at all.
That's not what I
Oh, really? My reputation precedes me. But the idea that there's references and there's layers of meaning to words that you can have one experience on the surface and then you can dig in deeper.
Yeah.
And deeper.
Yes, exactly. Quite literally, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just all about, the more economical the language I find, the more complex the response, the more varied the response, you know. So that's the game. I mean, that's what I think all artists do with, you know, whether they paint or sculpt. It's all just, you get into this thing of millimeters, that where it's like, no, let me say, I don't need that word, cut that word. You know, you're just trying to get it precise, you know, so it has the intended impact. But even then, you can't measure the impact. Like, everyone's going to have a different reaction, but as long as they have some reaction.
Yeah.
I'm going to shift gears for a second. So we're moving away from poetry and, well, I mean, we're not moving away from poetry, but we're moving away. Well, no, I can't say this either. So I'm just going to say it. Okay. So switching it up a little bit, this third thing I'm putting down is a very, very well-used copy of Alice Waters' The Art of Simple Food.
Yeah, it's like falling apart.
Yes, and I'm very proud of the state of this book. And as I put it in my bag this morning, my wife said, do you want a rubber band or something to keep it? I'm like, I promise I won't mess it up. So you'll see in here, I mean, first of all, we've stuffed other smaller cookbooks in here. The page completely, most of them have fallen out. You'll see there's writing on a lot of these pages where we've had to make adjustments.
Because I see some drips and splashes.
There's lots of drips and splashes. Yeah, very well used. And really, in a lot of ways, this book, my wife and I, we met in Chicago working at an organization called Young Chicago Authors. And we decided to move together. Sort of in the early days of our relationship, we had gotten engaged, and so we moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And in the process of that, you know, we're kind of coming out of that late 20s. I was getting into my 30s, sort of a different end of a chapter, an era of sort of like 20s, just kind of like out all night and just eating whatever, and like, you know, started thinking more about like, I should start cooking more, and like, I should learn to cook, and do I know how to cook, and you know, just kind of shifting into a new reality. And I started reading Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, and just starting to think about food more and just getting interested. I started buying appliances, you know, and so very early on, we bought this book, Alice Waters, The Art of Simple Cooking, and we just started trying out some of these recipes. And then this book came with us when we moved to Colorado and we had my son. Suddenly we're cooking a lot more. And a lot of the splatters and things in this book I attribute to a lot of those early days where we were cooking meals while holding him. And so, you know, things are all over the place. And so, you know, it sort of remained the foundation in a lot of ways for how we get down, which is we're not afraid of, you know, my son has a dairy allergy, so we, my wife especially, has gotten really good with cooking without butter and cream and stuff like that. But we, you know, we're big on flavor, fresh ingredients, you know, and this sort of like whole food mentality. That's not a shout out to the establishment, but it's just that the idea of just cooking, cooking at home, but not sacrificing flavor, not thinking about diets or any of that kind of stuff, but just, there's a saying that the best food is the food you pray over, which is basically just saying like the best food is the food you make yourself. So if it has fat, if it has whatever, it doesn't matter because you made it at home, which means it's got good stuff in it. It's good for you. You know what I'm saying? So I love this book. And I stopped myself when I said, oh, we're going to move away from poetry, because I do believe that, you know, cooking is a great art and there is a poetry to cookbooks. And even though, again, you know, part of why we have so much writing in here, too, is because we realize, like, oh, Alice Waters has a different palate than we do. Alice Waters doesn't like things to be too sweet. She doesn't like things to be too spicy. She wants to really taste the food. And, you know, my wife is Chicana from, you know, New Mexico. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, grew up, you know, in a predominantly African-American family. Like, we like flavor. You know what I mean? Like, we like flavor. We like kick. We want to taste the whole food as well, but so you, a lot of the writing is our little adjustments. Like, nah, Alice, I'm going to need more pepper, actually. Like, I'm gonna need, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going to need a little bit more in here. So to me, it's just a great document, though, of a important chapter in the maturation of my marriage and my family.
And then you remember when you made this thing or when you tried it or if it didn't work out. It was a game changer for me when I realized I could write in my cookbooks.
Yes, they're yours.
It's like, oh, wait, yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is not just instructions. It's a suggestion.
It's a start. It's a foundation.
Right.
So I'm not sure which is the better one. I'll just go with this one next. So again, I mentioned this play earlier, but I brought a published copy of And In This Corner, Cassius Clay, which is the first play that I wrote for Stage One. So my first play, How We Got On, was produced in Humana Festival 2012. That introduced me for the first time to the city of Louisville. But working on the And In This Corner, Cassius Clay project with Stage One really broadened and deepened my relationship with Louisville, because you know, we partner with the Muhammad Ali Center. And through working with them, I got to really go all over the city, because he's from the West End. And so we were going to the West End and we'd meet people who grew up with him. And we're going over to the Presbyterian Community Center over in Smoketown. And that's when I start to really see other parts of the city. Because, you know, coming to Humana, I was mostly just downtown and at Freddy's. You know what I mean? So is that place gone yet?
R.I.P. Freddy's.
Oh, it's gone?
It is.
God bless the dead.
Freddy's on Broadway.
God bless the dead. But those were the two places I knew. So working on this project really deepened my relationship with Louisville. And I would say a big part of why I chose to move here is attributed to that experience, you know, just deepening my understanding of it. And this play, you know, I think largely because Muhammad Ali is this international figure, this legendary icon, other cities have been producing the play a lot, and it's really, it's become one of my most produced plays. And I didn't expect that, you know. I understand it. Like, I get it, and I'm really proud of it, but I didn't see it coming. No playwright does. You know, you always assume this is going to be the one, and then it dies after one production, and then some other ones kind of do what you expected them to do, and then some other ones just, they just take off. So, but as a result, it's really, I feel like, brought Louisville to the rest of the country, like really mm-hmm. sort of showing and introducing and deepening people's understanding of the city and what it's contributed to America, you know, the United States as a whole
yeah.
entity. And so for me, it's a great case study or model in the way that I want to make theater, which is there's a community tie-in that it's specific. It can be regional. It can be specific. We can use the community to help us make it and deepen it. But then the rest of the world can find something that applies to them. They can still use it. So it can still be a Louisville play, but really also be an American play or be a global play. And that's what the experience of this play taught me. Mm. You know, so it's like I wrote my play. I did my job as a professional playwright, but it was the way that companies like Stage One, but then also, you know, Metro Theater in St. Louis or Nashville Children's Theater or Charlotte Children's Theater and now Seattle Children's Theater, the way that they're using it and the conversations they're having in their own communities mm-hmm. is showing me and reminding me of what this stuff can do, of what theater can do.
Mm. And I think we're having that conversation here in Louisville with Muhammad Ali's passing and seeing what he meant to yeah. the rest of the world
yeah.
in a huge way. As a Louisville native, I would rather have Muhammad Ali be the thing that people around the world know us for rather than like Colonel Sanders, which
oh,
has
yeah.
been my life's experience. Like, yeah. oh, you're from Kentucky? You mean
yeah.
like Kentucky Fried Chicken?
Oh, my.
Uh-huh, yep. Did you know Muhammad Ali was from Kentucky? You
yeah,
know, that's
exactly.
like, that to me is,
yeah.
is a better face for our city.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
Did you have a relationship with the idea of Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali as a kid? What were your
Well, you know, I mean, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And so, you know, he was still very much his sort of quote unquote prime
mm-hmm.
had passed him. But he was still out here. Like he was mm-hmm. much more visible. And you know, I consider him like a spiritual godfather of hip hop. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, that his whole swag,
Absolutely.
Like his whole, you know, sort of braggadocio, but socially minded. And, you know, he's talking about being fast and swift and pretty and he's rhyming and he's funny and charismatic. You know, I mean, that's the whole hip hop ethos.
You're
you know,
right.
he
yeah.
was like, he wasn't like Malcolm X or Martin Luther King Jr. You know, he wasn't a quote unquote leader in that way. He was like, I'm nice with these hands. And I'm funny and I can be, you know, he seemed like somebody in your family, you know,
mm-hmm.
he seemed like your awesome uncle or something like that, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? And so he was always just sort of a figure just sort of in the air. So when Peter Holloway, my predecessor, called me with the idea, I didn't even let him finish the sentence. I was like, stop. It's a no-brainer. Like, of course I'll write a play about the young life of Muhammad Ali. Forget about it. Yeah, no question. Like, it's already written. I just finished it. By the time you have time, it's written already. It's in your mailbox. Paperback copy of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and you will notice that it still looks pretty new,
and
that's because I only got it a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it a few years ago because I was asked by the Kennedy Center to write an adaptation, a very freely, wild, loose, barely adaptation
mm-hmm.
of Frankenstein, which I did, and it came out to be such a departure from the original that it was almost, unless you were told that, you may not know it or recognize it as Frankenstein. So subsequently, when Stage One asked about, hey, do you have a Frankenstein? They were like, we like your take on it,
uh-huh.
but we need something that people could more easily recognize as being
okay.
Frankenstein. So we're currently working on our production of Frankenstein, which will open in October. I've now adapted this book twice in just a span of a couple years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I brought this book for a few reasons. One is it's taught me that I actually love adaptation and it's something I want to actually do a lot more of in the future. I actually really like it. It's weird. It's kind of like retranslating in poetry, there's this thing called translations, which is you're not going word for word. You're trying to evoke what was the spirit, what were they trying to get at, but you want to maintain the artistry too. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what adaptation is. And to engage with another writer in that way, mm-hmm. I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah, right.
Because you're sort of like seeing what they're doing from a technical standpoint. Yeah. You're like, but I got you. I'm going to do it this way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to do it this way. But like, I think I'm still keeping what you mm-hmm. were going with. Mm-hmm. But then also just being like, look, you know, like, I get you. I get what you were trying to do in, mm-hmm. in 1818, but we got to do it this way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we got to do it this way now. Since you've been around, there's TV and there's movies and people understand story differently now. Mm-hmm. So, like, let me hook you up, you know? So,
I didn't realize it was 200 years old.
It's 200 years old. Mm-hmm. That's why we're doing it. It's okay. It's the 200 year anniversary mm-hmm. of the book. It's been a fun and interesting experience. Mm-hmm. But it's also, too, like, this is a book that I deeply respect. And I think, you know, Mary Shelley was really prophetic in a lot of the ideas that she was putting out, mm-hmm. you know, in the same way that, like, Orwell, you know, was. But it's not necessarily a quote-unquote enjoyable book, you know what I mean? It's really dark and it's really dense and, mm-hmm. but...
It's pretty slim.
Oh, but it's very small font.
I have to say, it is
tiny. It's very small font. So it's just been a real challenge to live in it, but I will say that it's made me, sort of reminded me of how far I've come as a writer, because if I was asked to adapt the same book twice in two entirely different ways 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know that I could have done it.
Yeah.
But I feel good. I feel like both of these Frankensteins that I've done really stand on their own. I feel like one could even do them both back to back
as a double feature.
As a double feature, uh-huh. yeah, because I feel that confident in how different they are, but how mm-hmm. they speak to each other as well. So
what have you learned about your craft from doing these two adaptations?
Well, I think there's a real big difference between craft and art.
Let's dig into that.
What do you mean? Well, craft is, it's just the technique. It's mm-hmm. it's like, it's why I love like chef shows and Project Runway, and I mean those shows are about craft and mm-hmm. execution, and really brings people into the world where it's like, so you can realize how hard folk work and how many real big decisions have to be made, you know, and you just don't know. There's so much of you not knowing, and it's so collaborative, and you need other people around you to push you, but also look at it and give you an honest answer of like, mm-hmm. This doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And you got to be like, okay, you're right, you know? these days I've become way more interested in pushing my craft and growing my craft and becoming a master, just being known as being a really good craftsperson. Mm-hmm. The art objects I make, the objects, the pieces, the products, if people find something useful in them, if they appreciate them, whatever, that feels great. But my real passion and pursuit is in the craft. Mm-hmm. And so that's what this Frankenstein endeavor reminded me of is I'm up for the task. I'm up for the task, which is if I need to adapt this book 5 more times, I'll do it. Will it be enjoyable? Maybe.
All right. It's about time for us to wrap up. I've got one last question for you.
Talk to me.
In the process of choosing these 5 things, which all happen to be books,
yep.
was there anything that you think you learned about yourself or discovered?
You know, there's this thing around my house where, you know, so my wife is a super reader, mm-hmm. just devours books, you know, even if she don't like them. She's just like, yeah, this book is whack. And then she's like,
she'll still finish.
And then I see her with it like 3 days later, just like towards the end, you know. And I'm the same way with music. But the sort of the popular thought around the house is that like she's the super reader, and that I'm more into music and films, and mm-hmm. you know, I kind of read random things, you know, nonfiction, you know, whatever, randomly. Mm-hmm. But in this process, I realized like I have a lot of like books are a big part. I just never thought of myself in that way, just because, you know, when I was younger, I just, you know, in grade school, and you realize how much grade school can do grade school has a power in defining you mm-hmm. for the rest of your life mm-hmm. in positive and negative ways. Mm-hmm. And I did not do well in grade school which is ironic that I, you know, students in college voted me the teacher of the year, but I had a horrible time in grade school in almost all areas. I think people assume like, oh, you must have been, you know, excelled in your English classes. And I was like, no, and just school. I just did not, I was not good at school.
Yeah.
I failed school, you know? and so I think I've always had this weird intimidation or insecurity about reading and thinking of myself as a reader and thinking of myself as, you know, I've always said, you know, I learn more from what I hear and I learn, you know, I'm that kind of person, you know, but going through this, I mean, I'm digging through just, oh, these are my current books and these are my old books and these are my, what books? Oh, these are the books I just got from the library. Da, da, da. It's just like, no, I like books. Like I am a reader. Like, I read, you know, I just don't, I just like what I like, you know, and I think I like very random things, and maybe perhaps that's what it is.
Yeah.
I haven't read the great works of literature, you know, the ones I have read, I've kind of been about, you know, I think I have more random tastes where it's like a cookbook, a book of poems, you know, a nonfiction book about issues at the border. But I definitely, books are a big part of my life.
It occurs to me that pretty much all these books, though, there's some aspect of performance or action in them, right?
Yeah, you're right.
These are not necessarily books that you just like inhale like a novel. We've got the cookbook, which is a roadmap for doing something.
Yeah.
You've got this book about the history of hip hop, which informed your work.
Yeah.
We've got a play script, which is just one tiny part of the play, right?
That's right.
So
similar to cookbook in a way.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And this one, Breakbeat Poets, that's about performing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It's about, there's a sonic element, there's an aural element to these, even as you're reading it, that you imagine what it's going to sound like when this poet does it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That there is a, if all together, I'm like, wow, and there's no novels in here. Oh, well, Frankenstein. But I only have it because I've adapted it twice.
Right, you said you didn't even really...
Yeah, I didn't love it. I mean, I didn't love it as a work. It's horrible. It's a horrible thing to say. But you know what I mean. Like, I respect it. But I didn't read it. I wasn't, like, flipping pages like, oh, my gosh.
What's gonna happen?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh, that's okay, I can take this. Okay, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is all stuff that you have engaged with
deeply. Yes.
Thank you so much for doing this.
This was almost like therapy in a way. I'm like, you know what? I am a good reader.
You are. Thanks again to Idris Goodwin for being my guest today. Today's show was produced, edited, and mixed by me, with editing oversight from Erica Peterson. Our theme music is by Alex Wright. You can get more information on our show at wfpl.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.